Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome back, listeners. I am your host, Carol Ann Tack. Thanks, as always, for joining me. And for this episode, we are headed overseas in The Last Lifeboat by today's guest, Hazel Gaynor. Hazel Gaynor is an award-winning New York Times, USA Today, Irish Times, and international best-selling award-winning author. And you probably all know many of her books, including one of my favorites from 2020, When We Were Young and Brave. Hazel Gaynor, thank you so much for joining me and the listeners of the Top Shelf podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
As I said, I loved 2020's When We Were Young and Brave. So when I read that book in 2020, you know, we were all at home and it was during COVID. But then I got so hooked from that book. I found your previous books as well as those amazing titles co-authored by you and Heather Webb. And what a amazing day that was for me, because then I went back and read the entire back catalog.
And that's so lovely to hear. I mean, as difficult and challenging as the pandemic was, it also gave people space and time to do exactly that. You know, whether it was discover a new author or discover a new talent. I mean, lots of new books were written during the pandemic. I kind of went the other way. I had less time because I had two children at home who needed to be schooled at home. And When We Were Young and Brave was a pandemic release. So it was kind of strange times, but incredible books still found readers. And we discovered the delights of Zoom and podcasts and innovative new ways to keep in touch, which have continued, which is fantastic. So, you know, I think a silver lining for us all that we could still connect and travel through the pages of great fiction, which was just a joy, wasn't it?
It was. And some people baked bread. I just read all Hazel Gaynor.
The famous banana bread and soda bread. all the creative ways we found to use overripe bananas. I mean, it was fantastic.
And then going down that rabbit hole with all of your work was such a joy for me to discover. So today, we are here to talk about your latest release, The Last Lifeboat.
Yeah, so The Last Lifeboat is set in 1940, in the second year of the Second World War, and it tells a story inspired by astonishing true events of children who were evacuated from Britain, but they were evacuated overseas. So these particular evacuees were known as sea evacuees, and they were sent away from Britain on ships that left to places like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, because of the fear and threat of invasion that was very much present in Britain at that time during the war. So I had heard of children being evacuated from the cities to the countryside in Britain, but I'd never heard of these overseas evacuations. So I followed this thread and read a story, this astonishing story of one of these seaVAC ships sailing from Liverpool to Canada that was torpedoed in the Atlantic by a German U-boat. And what happened was, in the rescue operation, one of the lifeboats from that torpedoed ship was missed. And it was believed that everybody who survived in that lifeboat had gone down with the ship. And it was only 8 days later that this miraculous story of survival came to light. And I just couldn't quite comprehend how had this situation arisen, what agony and anguish must parents have been going through to, first of all, make the decision to evacuate your child so far away. But then this worst possible nightmare, you know, there were obviously risks of taking such a journey during wartime. Certain conditions were set to try and assure parents that their children would be safe. So yeah, my story is a fictional account of a group of children and a woman who minds them in the lifeboat and the mother back in London in the Blitz. So just remarkable.
really a remarkable, moving piece of historical fiction. It is perfect for book discussions. It's about endurance, tests of inner strength. I love what author Susan Meisner says. She says The Last Lifeboat is an unforgettable story of survival, resolve, and the shimmering stubbornness of hope. And then Booklist says The Last Lifeboat is an emotionally compelling tale with a very different perspective of World War II. There are pages and pages of fantastic reviews about this book, and readers will agree with all of them as soon as they read it. It is on shelves everywhere right now. I know you said you read all of this material. What was that inspiration? How did you come upon this? Where did you find this story?
So I was looking for a slightly unknown angle or story about the Second World War, and I was intrigued by the evacuees. But I wasn't quite sure what it was actually that I was looking for. And I read an account on the Imperial War Museum website. They have just amazing first-person recollections of the experience of war. And I saw one word, and the one word was sea evacuees. And as I said, I never heard of children being evacuated away from Britain. And then when I went on to read this account of the city of Benares, this ship that was torpedoed, and not only that, but then this incredible survival story in a lifeboat, it really just felt like such a different story of the Second World War and had all those elements of human drama that I love to read about, that I love to write about, you know, these exceptional circumstances. And how do very ordinary people respond to that? So it came to me very quickly, actually, the need to tell this story through two points of view, two women. One of the women who volunteered to evacuate with these children to sort of escort them, if you like, on this long journey. And then a mother in London who is so far away. And we see the choices that she makes and how she deals with this news that arrives. So it really was quite an astonishing find. It felt like this little nugget of hidden history. And that to a novelist is really quite precious, you know, and it, how do you retell, how do you reimagine that lost account from the history books?
I love hearing that it appears as a nugget and then the lightning bolt strikes. I mean, that's just amazing. And all the readers are like, hooray. And full disclosure, I had never heard about the sinking of the SS City of Benares, or as it's called in The Last Lifeboat, it's called the SS Carlisle. I had never heard of Mary Cornish and her heroic efforts. When I think about Mary Cornish or any woman spending 8 days adrift in the Atlantic, responsible for, no spoilers, it's just not something I can conceive of. And you reveal this story in such a moving way, like all of your stories. You find these pieces of history and weave them into these just compelling and page-turning books. It's really something else. So when you sit down, you have this historical focus. You sit down and you begin to weave Alice and Lily and a terrific cast of characters into this story. As you were writing and putting all of these elements into the book, was there anything different with this one or surprising, or was there a big takeaway that's sort of different from the other books you've written?
Yeah, very much so. This book is told essentially over 8 days, these 8 days during which the lifeboat is missing. There's a little bit of moving back on that, a bit to set the scene for why was this government evacuation program put in place, and how did Lily and Alice come to, I guess, this crossroads, this intersection in their lives where they made these big, bold, brave decisions and the consequences of that. So, yeah, it was very much about finding those two characters and telling the story from those contrasting points of view. It's very different to tell a story in a setting that doesn't really change. So, for example, in When We Were Young and Brave, that's a story of the World War told really over the 5 years. And we're in China, we're moving around, there's all sorts of settings. With The Last Lifeboat, many of the scenes are in the lifeboat. So it was a challenge to, I guess, retain drama, suspense, tension when not much physically changes around my characters. And that was really interesting as a writer to dig deep and find those tiny, tiny things in a person's day we would do without thinking about it. But when you're in that situation and everything you do could determine your survival, every tiny thing becomes enormous. So it actually wasn't impossible to do, but it just was finding the way into those characters' lives in the lifeboat, and then contrasting that with Lily in London, who does have a little bit more movement around, but certainly contained because her evenings are spent in air raid shelters. So that sense of claustrophobia was very present. So very, very different for me to write such a small time frame, and I really, really enjoyed it.
And you would think, well, you're in this lifeboat, you're in the wide open sea, the sky above you, you wouldn't think you feel claustrophobic. I felt claustrophobic. I don't know how you did that.
Yeah, and that's it. the expanse of water, the expanse of sky, but because of that enormity of your surroundings, this tiny, tiny, helpless dot in all of that, in often stormy seas, you know, and this is all comes from the true account of what happened and the decisions that were taken, those human instincts to want to survive, but then other human beings can be quite annoying, can't they? So, you know, those strange interactions that come about when you're forced into close proximity with people you don't know, and yet you all have to pull together to try and get through this. So it was really interesting to recreate that sense of fear. Hope shines out, I think, from a lot of the scenes in this book, and the hope that you will be rescued, that help will arrive, even in the bleakest of times. Yeah.
Holy cow. Listeners, hold on to your hats. That's all I have to say about that. Alice King, Alice King and Lily Nichols, their stories. I mean, look, I was so riveted by The Last Lifeboat. I do want to talk about Alice first. She is the town librarian. She's a teacher. She feels safe in Kent. I mean, she thinks the war is far away, relatively. I mean, most people do, right? Don't they? That false sense of it's never going to happen here. But it is getting closer to Kent in this year of 1940. And you have this scene, this beautiful scene at the beginning of the book. And Alice is on her bicycle, and the scene reads, "It was a sunny, lavender-scented afternoon when it felt impossible that the world was at war. With Air Force training flights now being conducted over Kent's fields and coastline, the phony war had become much more visible and real. But the skies above Alice as she cycled were quiet and clear, and her mood matched the bright day. She laughed as she freewheeled along the dry rutted tracks, but her mood quickly changed as a sickening whine sliced through the warm air, the unmistakable sound of an aircraft in difficulty." Hazel Gaynor, your prose, good heavens, it is so good. I mean, there I was enjoying the afternoon with Alice, and I thought, how lovely is this scene? How beautiful are these sentences? And suddenly, there's an aircraft, and I was right there with her watching things unfold. Such a powerful moment.
Oh, gosh, thank you. It's actually quite emotional hearing you read that. You know, it was about 6 months that I finished the book. And it's really touching when you hear readers respond to those words. That I really vividly remember writing that scene. And it was the juxtaposition, I think, of the beauty of a summer's day, and yet this horror that was going on around everybody. And of course, not every day during the war was full of the worst things. Many days were quite dull and boring and normal. And it's really that contrast that I was trying to illustrate there of how can something so horrific be happening when everything's so beautiful? And Alice is really in touch with nature. She notices small things. You know, she notices the birds. She notices a bee trapped in a spider's web. You know, she's very connected to nature, which is very much part of me. And it was really, I guess, trying to catch that, I suppose, the nonsense of war in some ways. How can this be happening when the world seems to be continuing in all its ways? So, yeah, thank you for reading that so beautifully. It's really, really touching. And I this is why I just love being at this stage of the publication process, because a writer spends a long time with their thoughts and words. And when you connect with readers, the book begins all over again, and it's really special actually to hear that and to hear your response to it. So thank you.
Well, thank you for abiding my accent while I tried to relay that sense of beauty that you wrote to the listeners. So I can't wait for them to get there on their own. And I don't want to say too much more about Alice's story as that unfolds, but equally compelling is the perspective on behalf of Lily Nichols. Talk about writing Nilly's perspective. It's quite a viewpoint into what's happening on land.
Yeah. So as I said, I was quite clear from the start that I wanted two alternate points of view of this singular event. And it was very important for me. So you mentioned Mary Cornish, and Mary Cornish is the woman who was on the real ship and in the real lifeboat. And she very much inspired Alice, my character. Lily is entirely from my imagination, and she really encapsulates a lot of very ordinary women. She lives in a very humble terraced home in London, and she just has all of those emotions that any mother would have about keeping their children safe at a time of danger. But Lily also has other parts to her character. She's had hopes and aspirations that have changed over the course of her life. We get to see what has happened to Lily and her family before we meet them on the page in 1940. And that's unraveled and revealed as we go through the journey with her. And she was just a very interesting character to me. And what I think is fascinating about Lily is how she responds to this choice of, do you want to send your children overseas, or do you instinctively want to keep them with you despite the dangers that are inherent in doing that? And also her response to the news that she receives. And again, without giving too much away, which is tricky, but we see different sides to her character and those unexpected places we can often go to when faced with trauma, drama, fear, and hope. And I loved writing her, and I really feel she speaks for a lot of women whose voices were really not heard much during the war. So she was an embodiment, I think, of lots of very real women who pounded the streets of London and ran into those air raid shelters. Yeah.
And your character development, I mean, all of the characters, Alice's siblings, Howard and Richard, and I'm not saying anything else about them, but it is excellent character development, readers. You are in for such an experience with this book. I want to switch to sort of the technical side of things about the novel itself, the prologue. Was that always how The Last Lifeboat was going to start?
Yes. And it's not often that the first things you write down in a book are what end up on the finished page. I have a notebook. I write on a laptop or a desktop computer, but I have a notebook. And in one of my notebooks, where I wrote very, very early ideas for The Last Lifeboat, is a scene, and it's very, very similar actually to what has ended up in the finished book, despite numerous edits and numerous drafts. The character was called Annie, and we meet her in that first dramatic moment after the torpedo has hit, and we feel her sheer panic and bewilderment at what has happened and how is she responding to this situation that she can't actually believe she's in. And the words I wrote in my notebook are very close to the words that the readers will read now. And it just felt like the only way to start this book, to start this story, was to jump right into that moment of panic. And then we step back a little bit and go back a few months, not very far, just a few months, to see how on earth has this happened. Who is this woman? Why is she there? And how these component parts and all the characters we meet all sort of dovetail together eventually. So yeah, quite rare that that happens, but this time it stuck.
Yeah, I love that you use the word jump right in, because that's not that.
She does.
She does. When We Were Young and Brave, as we spoke about earlier, was published during 2020, during the pandemic. Where were you with the writing of The Last Lifeboat? Were you already deep into the writing stages, or?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, readers often are surprised when they hear how far ahead or how far back, I suppose, a book was begun. So I had already pitched the idea to my agent. I was doing research. Those early chapters were being written. So back in 2020, when We Were Young and Brave was released, The Last Lifeboat was already underway. I was also writing another book with Heather Webb, which was then published in 21, called Three Words for Goodbye. So most of my writing time was being spent on that because I had a publication date for that. But The Last Lifeboat was really my escape from the book that Heather and I were writing together. And we were quite far on in that. So that felt very different to write. And every now and again, I would just sort of step into The Last Lifeboat. And I was finding my story then. So I was just really researching, putting down thoughts and scenes, figuring out, how do I tell this story? Meeting my characters, you know, I don't plot, I write quite organically. So it was a little palate cleanser, I suppose, from the story Heather and I were writing. And then once that book was published, I had a bit more clear air to go back and really dig in to The Last Lifeboat. So it was really, really interesting to be writing and with everything else going on during the pandemic. So it's taken a long time to get The Last Lifeboat to readers. So this is amazing.
The other thing you do in the book is you include these mass observation diarist pieces. Talk about including them, how you found them, and et cetera.
Yeah, the mass observation, and again, another phrase, another part of the war I didn't know about. So the government invited 500 volunteers from all walks of life across Britain to keep a diary, to really just capture the ordinary person's real response to the war. And they were really left to interpret that how they liked. So they could write every day a couple of lines, or they might write more significant pieces once a week. And these were all submitted to a government department called the Ministry of Information, which sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Yes, it does.
But it was a real department that was partly dealing with propaganda, you know, and trying to keep morale up, keep spirits up. And these diary entries were submitted and they're kept now in an archive at the University of Sussex. And these are all brilliantly shared in a book called Blitz Spirit by Becky Brown that I read actually at the time when I was writing and researching The Last Lifeboat. And in my book, I have created fictional accounts from my imagined contributors to that diary, to that archive. And it really felt like, again, just one of those wonderful nuggets from the war that's maybe not as well known, and allowed me to, I suppose, take a beat between tension and drama of the story and just step into another person's voice. And it becomes clear to the reader who's talking as we move through the book. And it was just really interesting to pull in other little voices, opinions, little snippets of life from the war through those little placeholders, I guess, through the book. So really fascinating. The book itself, Blitz Spirit, is a really warts and all account of war. Very funny, actually, in places. And that fed into my little scenes as well. Humor isn't something we'd often associate with war, but people were very witty in how they talked about what was happening.
Loved having them in the book. Very impactful. So when you published When We Were Young and Brave, it has a different title in the UK. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure how that happens. The title was The Bird in the Bamboo Cage, equally as good as the other title. Today's book, The Last Lifeboat, did that have a different title? Was that the original title? And was there something different coming for US versus the UK readership?
Actually, with this book, it was always going to be The Last Lifeboat for both published versions, which makes life a lot easier. The last book, it was quite complicated, I think, and two very, very different titles. It's not uncommon. It can just be two. A particular publishing market maybe has a similar title to the one that works in the other territory. So it's very kind of subtle marketing changes, really. But I have to say, it's so much easier to talk about a book when it has the same name everywhere. So originally, I had named this book I Regret to Inform You was its working title. That was just the first thing that came to me. And then there were various iterations. Titles are a tricky thing to get right. Lots of back and forth with my editors, my agent, creatives. And we really felt we had to have the word lifeboat or ship or something in here. The real ship, the City of Benares, that was torpedoed, was known as the children's ship. And that was a consideration at one point. Just, I felt very much that the lifeboat in The Last Lifeboat almost becomes a character of its own. And I felt very strongly about the word lifeboat. There's something about a lifeboat that speaks of hope and rescue, and yet we hope we never need to use it. So it felt right. And The Last Lifeboat, because this missing lifeboat was the last one to leave the sinking ship. And that's partly why it was missed, because it was more watertight and it sailed away from the rescue area. And of course, the last two accounted for. So yeah, it's a beautiful title. And I really feel it works in terms of directing the reader towards what they may expect from the story.
Not only the title, but then you look at the United States cover, so dramatic, and you really sort of, you have a bird's eye view of these poor people in this lifeboat. Equally as dramatic as the UK cover, but there's something about the US cover that, well, obviously I'm from the US, so it's me the right way, I suppose. Talk about those two covers. I mean, how do you choose which one? Do you have a say in that? Because they're both equally fantastic.
Thank you. And yeah, I have to say, I mean, the US cover was the one I saw first, and it just blew me away. And actually, the first mock-up of that cover is, again, very close to what we finished with. It didn't change much at all, and that is quite rare. And it was just this, I think it's a very cinematic cover, which is beautiful, because that's how I write, quite cinematically. And that bird's eye view just is a really different perspective. And what's beautiful about that bird's eye view, the little characters in that boat, the children, they actually are based on the photographer who designed the cover, photographed his granddaughter in different poses, and she is the model for those children in the lifeboat, which is just a beautiful extra piece of something that lends itself so beautifully to that cover. I was absolutely blown away when I saw that. Equally loved the cover for the UK, Ireland and Australia. Again, just the sense of hopelessness of that ship, that lifeboat in a vast ocean. Something about that bird's eye view and seeing a couple of people, I think that just adds a sense of, I want to know who they are. I want to know what's happening. So yeah, I think the design team at Berkeley Penguin Random House just knocked it out of the park. And I've had so many compliments about that cover. And it really is striking.
And it is one of those books that when I received the box of galleys from Penguin, I opened up the box and I think this was right on the top. And I said, oh, Hazel Gaynor. Okay, that's it.
Yes.
So I stopped everything that I was doing. This was going in my travel bag. This is more credit. I know I shared some scenes with you on Instagram of me at the beach holding up the book. It has traveled well across a couple of different countries and it has come with me. It is a beautiful cover and I love knowing the background of the children in the boat. Very, very interesting. And I love hearing that story. So here you are, your book tour is in full swing. Where is the best place that readers can find you, where your upcoming events are, and if you're going to be making it over to our neck of the woods at any time?
Yeah, so I'm in a crazy time where I'm not quite sure what day it is, but that's a lovely situation to be in. I've done lots of events in Ireland. I was in the UK last week meeting booksellers and readers, which was so lovely because my last book was a pandemic release. So this feels like a very long time coming to do this again. For readers in the States, unfortunately, it didn't work for me to come this time. My son had his exams through school, so he's just finishing them now. So hopefully before too long, I'll have my boots on the ground in the US because I have such fabulous readers there who've been with me from the beginning. I've been lucky to tour in the States a few times, but not for a long time. So all of my events and recordings will be on my Facebook page, Hazel Gaynor Books. I'm on Instagram far too often at Hazel Gaynor and on Twitter at Hazel Gaynor. And my website, you can sign up for my newsletter, which I tend to send out once a month. But through those various things, you'll find links to different events and recordings if you miss it. I love, love, love hearing from readers. So if anyone's listening and wants to reach out, please do. It's really lovely to hear from readers. And I really encourage you to keep in touch. So do.
Well, you don't have to worry about me. Anything you can share about what might be next for you, what you're working on?
Yeah, I have two projects on the go. So I can tell you more about one than the other. So my next book with Heather Webb is coming next fall 24, and it's called Christmas with the Queen, and is a novel inspired by the late Queen Elizabeth II's traditional Christmas message on Christmas Day. And we're setting it in the 1950s. And we have two fictional characters, a chef in the royal household and a BBC correspondent whose relationship, shall we say, revolves around coming together at Christmas for this tradition. And it's really about how the Queen established herself as part of Christmas Day for families in Britain. So a really beautiful, romantic Christmas book that we're working on. And my next solo book, I unfortunately can't say too much about yet. We haven't announced. We will soon, hopefully. But I can tell listeners that it is going to be based in the US. It's a historical still, you'll be pleased to hear, set in the 1930s in the Dust Bowl era. What's different this time is this is an origin story. It's a reimagining of a very familiar story, which I pitched to my editor as a story you know, a woman you don't. And I am so excited to reveal all when I can.
I am getting the chills for that. Holy cow. I'm all in. That's amazing, amazing, amazing. I will wait with bated breath for that. And good luck finishing it and putting all of that together. I know you don't have any time with this, your son and the exams and this book tour. Anything you can share with readers, book recommendations, any book recommendations you have?
Oh, gosh, always. I've read some just astonishing books recently. Kristen Harmel, her new book, The Paris Daughter. Kristen just writes such beautiful stories of the war. Again, you know, this is very much about a mother's choice. So it really resonated with me having written The Last Lifeboat. I believe it's a New York Times bestseller right now and fully deserved. Kristen's just an incredible human being and deserves all the success. So beautiful look at the Second World War. Very differently, I also recently read and loved a book called Yellow Face by Rebecca Kwang, who wrote Babel. Yellow Face is just about, it is a literary thriller set in the world of publishing. It's just fabulous. It's so interesting as a writer to have read her insights into publishing. And it just rips along. It's brilliant characterization. And it really takes a look at cancel culture, toxic friendships. A lot of debate has been had recently about who gets to tell whose story. And she goes there and it's absolutely fascinating. I loved it. Real, it's fun, dark fun. So those two I've really enjoyed recently.
Yellow Face is fearless.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, it's brilliant. I was on the edge of my seat with that book. I couldn't believe what I was reading. I will post all of the information on the podcast page for this episode. Listeners, just a reminder, The Last Lifeboat by today's guest, Hazel Gaynor, is a most anticipated book by Real Simple. She reads BookBub and more. And the best news is that you don't have to anticipate this book any longer because it's on shelves right now at your local library, at your local independent bookstore. The Last Lifeboat is published by Berkeley. Hazel Gaynor, I cannot thank you enough for joining all of us here today on Top Shelf. I really hope you will come back for whatever you do next.
I absolutely will. And this has been such a joy. Thank you for such great questions. And thank you to everyone for listening.
Listeners, thanks so much for joining me today. Remember to follow Top Shelf on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you find your podcasts for the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library. Check out our website at merricklibrary.org. Thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Diane Bondi, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and on to the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.